Recorded live in Newtown, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to Season 5, Episode number 4 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin and Kaylee and Simon are on leave today. Joining me, not in the Cinematica studio this time, I'm not in the Cinematica studio, I'm in my home office in Newtown in Wellington, but on the line from that Auckland is Darren Bevan from TVNZ Online and also Darren's World of Entertainment. G'day Darren.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
Look, I'm thrilled to finally get you on the show after so many attempts.
Yes, we have a thwarted past, don't we, of trying to be on these kind of things together. Apparently, recording devices that you were using failed to work properly, and then timing's been an issue. But I'm finally glad to be part of Cinematica after 5 elusive seasons.
And bless you for blaming the technology rather than the operator error.
Well, everyone knows that any bad workman blames his tools, right?
Indeed. So look, here's how the show lines up today. A classic Aussie book becomes a classic Aussie film in Tim Winton's The Turning. We review the film and also interview one of the producers. And the Marvel Universe gets even more complicated with the latest episode of Thor's saga, The Dark World. But first, let's talk a little bit about you, Darren, and how you got into this talking about film dodge.
Good grief, I didn't realise this was going to turn into an episode of This Is Your Life. Probably provide a potted history rather than started with being born, I guess.
Exactly. What's that old joke about I was born in London because I wanted to be close to my parents.
I was born in the north of England, actually, I sympathise with the likes of Brastoff and the Full Monty, although stripping and playing trombone have never been part of my career so far, but, you know, never say no, as they say. For years and years in the UK, I was working on radio as a journalist and heading to movies and enjoying movies, and gradually sort of started to get into I'm seeing quite a lot of movies, maybe I have a few opinions of my own on these films. And then eventually when I moved over here a good nearly 8-9 years ago, I was offered the opportunity by a wonderful online site called The Lumiere Reader, who I got involved with early on, and then just kind of followed it from there. And really, it's become a love and appreciation of film, and there's a lot of film released every year. I mean, you and I both know that there's so much stuff out in cinemas that it's nearly impossible to see all of it some of the time. But I think there are those kind of gems lurking around that you don't necessarily know about unless someone tells you about them, really.
Exactly. And, you know, the whole point of Cinematica, and I'm sure your site as well, is that we love going to the pictures. You know, we love the extra effort that you make to go out, you dress up, well, at least you should, and you make a night of it, and sitting with a whole lot of people in a dark room watching a glowing rectangle on the screen rather than at home interrupted by your flatmates and getting up for a cup of tea and all the rest of it, the actual process of going to the movies is still the best way to experience all of these works of art. And if you don't, and you can't sort of really pick and choose, you love it all. It's just a matter of degrees, right?
Yeah, and I think there are different ways of viewing films these days. I mean, you and I are probably in the privileged position that we don't always have to see films with the public, but when we get back into these public screenings, it's always interesting to note the kind of reaction that people have to films and the enjoyment that they bring, as well as the frustrations of the mobile phones and the rustling of crisp packets and one thing and another and sweets and stuff like that. But I think there's that kind of buzz. Every time I go into a film, I very rarely know what I'm likely to come out with. I'm one of those kind of reviewers, and I've been doing reviewing for about 9 or 10 years now. I like to go in knowing as little as possible about the film, in the kind of extent that, I'll avoid trailers when they come out. I'll post them up on my site, obviously, because that's what people want to see. But we see so much stuff. There's so little opportunity these days to be surprised by what unfolds on the screen. And I think seeing that and a flavour of the reaction that people have is just magical, and it's wonderful. And there are gems out there, as I said earlier, that you don't see unless you get out to them. For me, it was going to see Once a couple of years back. I very nearly didn't go to a screening of that. I'd had an awful day. I was just tired. I was miserable. I wanted to go home. I had this opportunity to go and see this film. And I was transformed in the cinema. It transcended me to somewhere that was magical. The music was fantastic. And it became a film that myself and my wife utterly adore. And we share that passion now. And I don't think you can underestimate the kind of effort and the reward that you get from going to the cinema when the lights go down these days.
Indeed, indeed. And talking of some of the less savoury aspects of going to the movies these days, we'll go and have a look at the mailbag. And this particular tweet from Matthew Buchanan, MRB, on Twitter, he said a couple of days ago, politely booted the seat in front of me in your honour on Saturday night as a Facebook timeline glowed at me in the dark. Well, that's good. We obviously don't condone vigilante action at the movies, but of course, you know, we're not going to turn a we're not going to turn a blind eye. There may be a certificate coming quietly through the mail to support you, Matthew. Thank you very much there. We've got a few two-word reviews. The Murker, Chris Horman, he's seen Thor The Dark World, and his two-word review for that is Spectacular Norse. Fred Thompson's also seen Thor The Dark World, and his two-word review is Better Darker. He says there's a great mix of action, romance, and humour, and a nice setup for Avengers 2. Reese Pye in England, her two-word review of Enough Said, which we get in just a couple of weeks, I think, but already out in England. She's taking advantage, she says, of the ampersand exclusion, which is our own particular brand of cheating. Sweet and sad for Enough Said. And I notice after last week's show, Darren, you were a little bit concerned about whether I needed some assistance eating ice cream. I don't want it to seem like I'm somehow incapable of spooning ice cream into my mouth. But, you know, you just don't want to take your eye off the screen for any reason. And you have to if you're going to get right into the corners of those tubs.
I fear you won't have a career as a sports person if you can't coordinate like that, if you're worried about what's in front of you and not what's going on down in front of you as well. So I fear your career as a New Zealand's next top sports person is probably in danger, Dan.
My ambitions for the New Zealand rugby league team were extinguished many, many years ago, I have to say. We've got a two-word review for Enough Said from Robert Catto in Sydney, and his was Bitter Sweet. So that is the mailbag for today. I hope that I did it as well as Kaylee normally does it. And it's time to just have a little bit of a look at what people have been going to see this weekend, the New Zealand Top 5. Actually, we'll start at number 6 because from a distributor that I'm unfamiliar with, Saggy Motion Pictures, week number 1 for Krish 3. Yes, Bollywood makes it into the top 10 big time with a decent box office in New Zealand this week of over $60,000. Number 5, dropping 2 places, is Beyond the Edge, the Sir Edmund Hillary documentary with a bit of drama thrown in. Number 4, holding steady, is About Time. Dropping 1 place to number 3, Gravity, still holding strong, and with a gross box office in New Zealand to date after 5 weeks of about $3.2 million. Captain Phillips is down 1 at number 2, and that's still doing pretty good business, but of course straight in at number 1, Thor The Dark World, which we'll be talking about a little bit later on. And that's over $1 million in the first 4 days. That's just the weekend, of course. And Mr. Pip, which is at number 7, which is holding very steady, has also cracked that elusive $1 million mark, which for a New Zealand-produced film is pretty much the difference between whether you make money or don't make money in the New Zealand context. And so congratulations to Mr. Pip for that.
Darren,
anything to contribute on the, on that? Anything? Any surprises?
Not really. I mean, I'm not entirely surprised that Gravity's doing well. I think the long-tail marketing campaign that they've had with that, it just continues. I know it's only just opened, I think, this week in the UK. Mm. So once again, we've got Twitter and Facebook all covered with debate about the film. But, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. It's a brilliant, brilliant film, don't get me wrong. But I think the marketing and the continual talkability of this film is just possibly one of the, maybe one of the film highlights of the year, actually, in terms of getting word out and getting people out to the cinema.
Yeah, and not only that, but it's also a grown-up film, like when I say grown up, I mean a film that appeals to grown ups and not sort of teenagers and kids necessarily. But it's a kind of film that can only be seen in a cinema, really, only be really fully experienced in a cinema. And I think that on that basis alone, it's to be applauded because, you know, let's hope that all of this money means that all of the studios, all of the big money people are going looking for original ideas rather than just recycling and rehashing. That would be good news. Looking at this top 10, the big disappointment for me, this staggering really, is that Runner, the Justin Timberlake, Ben Affleck thing, has made nearly $300,000 in New Zealand, and which is only a little bit under, only about $30,000 under Prisoners, which, you know, we didn't necessarily all enjoy, but was still a 10 times better film. So not everything in the garden is rosy, shall we say. Now it's time to turn our attention to The Turning.
What did it feel like? The moment you suddenly got it?
I saw things. Well, I don't know, I half saw things.
You used to treat me like a trophy. I was your prize. What did it feel like? The moment you turned. I woke
up to find. So Tim Winton's book of short stories, which could be a novel, I suppose, if you wanted to treat it that way. It reads as if they're individual short stories, but as you get through them, you start to realise there are many, many connections between those stories and the characters within them. It's been turned into a very unusual and unique piece of cinema entertainment, because each of the individual short stories in the book has been turned into a specific individual short film, and those short films have been collected. They're screened in the same order as the book itself, and this is quite an unusual piece of work. And it's long, it's over 3 hours long. There's an interval, you get a glossy program as if you've been going to the theater. In Australia at least, they're charging premium prices for it, and it's just been a phenomenal success there. What did you make of The Turning, Darren?
I'm going to plead some kind of ignorance here on this one. I have seen the film, had no knowledge of the book whatsoever, so kind of felt a little bit, went in not quite sure what to expect. Normally we tend to get sent press kits on films, and people doing the publicity for The Turning were very determined that we get the press kit before the film. But I've taken a policy a good few years back that I don't tend to look at press notes anymore after one film from a while back revealed a massive spoiler in its synopsis, which really irritated me before I'd even had the chance to see it play out. But I have to say, with The Turning, I really wish that I had broken my rule, because I felt that I didn't quite get the subtleties of this brilliant piece that was put together, because I wasn't aware of all the interconnections and the clever way that it's been beautifully realised.
Yeah, I was very much in the same boat, actually. All I knew going into the screening that I went to was that it was a bunch of short stories, and I thought that it was going to be a kind of celebration of Winton-ness, you know. And like, I've read a Winton novel and loved it, and thought it would make a great feature film, and so I was expecting that. And then after about six of these films, I started to realise that there were connections between the characters, not just thematic or visual connections, and that there possibly was a lot more going on under the surface there than I had been aware of. I saw it without an interval as well, which meant that I couldn't stop and talk to my fellow cinema goers and say, what the heck is going on here? That makes it a little bit, I think the interval would make it a little bit easier for audiences, because some of those short films are extremely intense, and it is worthwhile, I think, having a bit of a break and a breather and a pit stop and a chance to sort of get your mind together before going back into for the remaining short films. Each of the short films is adapted and directed by a different team. Some of those directors are first-time directors. They're well known for their acting skills. Mia Wasikowska, David Wenham being an example. I think it's something really cool that, you know, there is no thematic, or not thematic, there's no stylistic connection between any of these short stories. Were there any that stood out for you, Darren?
Yeah, I think, I mean, ambition really, really shines through in this film. And with any kind of short story and short film, there's going to be varying quality. But I just thought that all beautifully, beautifully shot, wonderfully put together and sublimely acted. I mean, the one that's getting a lot of attention, and quite rightly so, is the Rose Byrne one, The Turning, where she plays, she's basically a trailer park dweller who's a domestic violence victim. And I think I'm right in saying that that's where the actual intermission comes after her film, which I think is probably a good time to, you know, take stock and drop back and recalculate. That one really stood out to me because that tells essentially a whole film's worth of story within 10 minutes. And each of these films is about 10 minutes long. So I think with anything, if you're not entirely blown away by what you're seeing, you don't have to wait long until another one comes by. But having said that, I did start to feel maybe the ones that I've been slightly dismissive towards, I wish that I could see again once I worked out that there was some kind of link in them. I mean, there's no film on there that's not there for a reason, if you see what I mean. When you adapt a book, you leave chunks out, you leave bits out. This is a kind of film that doesn't need to have those kind of themes dropped and moved all around. So The Turning, the actual short film The Turning, really stood out for me. And there was also another one called Fog, which was about a policeman and corruption within a police force, which I thought was wonderfully, wonderfully evocative. And this character finds himself called to locate a hiker that's gone missing in the mountains and trapped with a reporter trying to work out what he's supposed to do and whether he breaks the code of silence that's within the force. And I thought that was just haunting, really. I think it's perhaps the best way to describe it.
There's another terrific film, and you can remind me of the name of this one, which stars Hugo Weaving. It's the one that's directed by David Wenham, where that character, that policeman character, returns, played by a different actor, and it's a much later stage in his life, and in which he's found by his son out alone in a shack out in the outback, and the two men sort of have a very quiet, meaningful, emotionally sort of suppressed reuniting, and I found that was the one that really resonated for me out of the collection, partly because of the wonderful performances, and, you know, Hugo Weaving, just one of the most wonderful screen actors that Australia has ever produced, but also because the location of that film reminded me very much of one of my favourite Australian films, Wake in Fright, which starred Donald Pleasance, of all people, back in 1971, a fantastic film, but it's also set in that very, very remote sort of dried, dusty outback. You remembered the name of the David Wenham film?
Yeah, it's
The Turning?
Commission.
Commission, brilliant.
Because I think it's talking about a commission, a royal commission that happened in Australia. I think half the problem with The Turning for me is that it's a cultural ignorance. I'm not kind of au fait with a lot of the events of Australia just yet, so it's those kind of moments really, really were slightly lost on me. But I think it's the scope of this and the ambition and the fact that there is that interconnection within this portmanteau and a universality and a desperation that really kind of resonates. I don't think there will be anyone that will see this kind of event piece of cinema that won't be touched by one part of it. I mean, yeah, some aren't as successful as others, but, I mean, just the overall feeling is that it's something special and something unique and needs to be applauded for that.
Yeah, well, I'm going to put you on the spot now and see if you can come up with two words to describe a 180 plus minute film, or, you know, 18 films or however many it is. It's like this, it's almost an impossible exercise, but I'm going to ask you to do it anyway.
I'm going to go with short smorgasbord.
Okay, good stuff. I'm going to say epic Australiana, because this, I reckon, is if you haven't been to Australia, or if you don't know Australia, you'll get a really good idea of what sort of the underbelly of Australian culture is. I mentioned this actually when I was talking to Maggie Miles, one of the producers of The Turning, in an interview that we recorded last week. So this seems as good a time as any to introduce her to the show and play that tape. Maggie Miles, co-producer of The Turning, welcome to Cinematica.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. Now, The Turning is a film unlike any that that I've seen before, and unlike anything that's come out of Australia before. Can you? How do you describe it when people ask you?
It's a very unique film, is how I describe it. And what I try to do is just talk about the book when I talk about The Turning, because it's a book in chapters and the film is then in chapters. And the film is an adaptation of this book, which is set around a particular place but has lots of different fragmented stories which connect to that place, but that don't follow in a sequential order. On screen, it's a cinematic work by 18 different directors who have interpreted those chapters of the book. I guess that's my description.
And it's conceivable, or to the reader of a book, that you're actually not reading a book of short stories at all. You're actually reading a novel told in a particularly interesting and unusual way. Was there ever a thought behind actually just adapting the Turning and turning it into just a straight story from beginning to end?
No, there wasn't. Robert Connolly, who optioned the book from Tim Winton and who's the originator and key creative force on the project, discussed with Tim Winton very early on this idea of taking a punt, you know, having a cinematic experiment and putting together this slightly unwieldy plan that might work or might not. There had been a stage adaptation of The Turning done a few years prior, and from that one cohesive story was written for the stage. And Tim Winton actually wasn't keen on that idea, and the reason he loved Rob's, creative thoughts about the novel and about translating it to the screen was because the structure of the novel was being honoured in that way and being played with, if you like.
What was your involvement? How did you become involved in this project?
Well, I produced a low-budget film called Van Diemen's Land a few years ago by director Jonathan Alfterhide, and we made that film on a really short budget, had to be quite innovative in the way that we produced it, and developed a really strong team ethic amongst the crew and the production office. And Robert Connolly had seen that whole thing take place and liked it, and so asked Jonathan and I to be involved in Chapter Fog, which Jonathan directed. And then from that, Rob said to me, well, you know, maybe you'd like to think about being across the feature, you know, across the entire feature. And from that moment on, I just personally had this opportunity that I wasn't going to let go of. It was such a brilliant idea, such an exceptional team that Rob had brought together, and an amazing and really unique project. And from then I actually became involved not only on the feature but on five of the little chapters. And that was what was so interesting really about my involvement, because being involved in the coalface and making these tiny little works in really gritty production kind of standards, if you like, you know, we were sleeping in tents and all mucking in together, was it was really important for me to have that knowledge while also working with Rob to manage the overall feature. And so that's kind of a bit of an overview of where I fit in.
So how challenging was it to sort of keep that overview going? And did the individual filmmakers coordinate in any way? Was there did you have a grand production meeting at the beginning of the process where they got to talk to each other? A conference?
Yeah, I sometimes wondered about that, but it didn't happen like that. I wondered if we would ever have a moment when everyone was together, but pretty much the first time when all of the directors were in the same place, except for David Wenham, because he was performing on stage, was at the world premiere where they all saw each other's work. What's really great about Rob Connolly creatively is he keeps things open, and all the time, constantly through the process, we would kind of check in, look at what was happening, what chapters had been shot, what chapters had been put in place, look at the scripts that had come in, what was going to happen in the next phase of time. And then we kept asking the same questions really about how these works fitted together, what connected them, what set them apart. Should we kind of drop this little bit of information into this team, or should we just leave them to it? You know, so in a way it was a very intuitive process that unfolded, and not all of the teams were locked in at the very beginning. Some of them, due to availability and different things, took a little bit of a while. So they were shot between kind of September in one year to May the following year. So it was a really broad stretch of time. And one thing we did do was we created a document. So we had a young writer put together a document which looked at the themes of Tim Winton's novel, The Turning, which looked at the recurring imagery, which looked at the recurring characters and the place in which it was set. And so we had this document, and some of the teams used it very heavily and some of them didn't. Some of the teams stayed very closely to the details of the story in the book, and then others kind of, you know, took a key scene or a key moment and then improvised from there. So it really was a very diverse, creative dynamic.
And one story is told in the form of modern dance, which comes as a big surprise, particularly at that particular moment in when you're watching the film, because you sort of feel like you've got a handle on where things are going, and then this thing turns up. Was that always the plan, or was that something that was pitched to you?
Well, it was always the plan from very early on that Yaron Lifshitz, who's the choreographer, artistic director of Circa in Queensland, would create a chapter. He's an old friend of Robert Connolly's and an incredible creative mind. And when we were looking at which chapter perhaps to suggest, or Yaron, you know, there was a discussion happening. Immunity, which just happens to be the last but one chapter in the novel, is a story about a girl on a train who has admired a boy, which is Vic Lang, for years, but hasn't been able to pluck up the courage to talk to him. So it was this relationship without much dialogue. And Yaron loved the chapter and went through this amazing creative process, put together this incredible brief about it, and you know, then the whole production of it was just took us by surprise at every stage. You know, they just kept coming back with ideas and work, which got richer and richer and richher. And in terms of the audience, the order, we had lots of discussions again about what would we think about in terms of how would the order work. You know, what considerations do we want to take into account when placing or curating these chapters or these stories? And the first time we assembled the feature, we said, well, let's start with the order of the book. You know, what a revolution that was. And so we put them in order and we just didn't change it. And so that's why Immunity is the last but one chapter.
The film isn't just an interpretation of Winton's book. It also works, I think, really well as a portrait of modern Australia. That if you didn't know Australia very well, if you didn't live there, you would probably get a fair idea of what the place was like in many of its different aspects from looking at the different stories that are told. The reaction inside Australia has been quite phenomenal too. And I know I hear that you've cracked $1 million at the domestic box office.
Yes, we have. Isn't that, that's so amazing, because it just means that all those people have gone to see the film, you know. It's a really exciting moment,
And so is it being used as a sort of to prompt discussion about Australianness?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we hope that the turning will be picked up by schools, and then there are a number of different applications or, subject discussions that can happen around that. And one of the treats for us in the release, which is Madman and Cinema Plus over here in Australia, is that we held an event release whereby lots of the filmmakers directly engaged with that release, and so we were able to directly interact with audience members. And I found myself being so intrigued by those comments that you've just described, that people talk about the turning as this incredible document in a way from which discussions around Australian culture, contemporary Australia, diverse Australia, etc., can happen. And I think that's something which maybe might be drawn out over time. It's not something that has, you know, led the conversation in terms of the media necessarily, or the types of comments that we've made about the film, but it just seems as though this is an impact that it's having, is that people are starting to reflect on contemporary Australian society using this or being triggered by this film, which is what's so exciting, because you put something out there and while people can tell you whether they liked it or they didn't like it, hopefully it will also spark a bit of a conversation, and that's what seems to be happening, which is great.
Look, we're really looking forward to seeing the film open in New Zealand, and no doubt it will have a very different impact here, you know, across the ditch. But, you know, it'll be very interesting to see whether our New Zealand audiences respond to it and feel like they're just that little bit closer to their cousins across the Tasman. Maggie Miles, thanks very much for your time, and really appreciate you being on Cinematica.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's Maggie Miles, one of the producers of The Turning, which opens all over, well, not in fact all over New Zealand, very, very select cinemas in New Zealand, and only in Auckland, Wellington and Christchurch. It is going to make it a bit of a challenge for those people who are outside of those three main centres to see it. But who knows, maybe the business this weekend will be so good that they extend it out to some of the smaller centres. That would be good news. Well, the big news for Wellingtonians and for New Zealand fans of The Hobbit was the special Hobbit Fan Day yesterday, where Hobbit fans at cinemas in four different locations around the world were all sort of connected via the internet so that they could see some of the stars of the next Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug. Am I getting that right? Oh, the details.
Smaug.
Smaug. God.
Smaug.
Blimey. So you can tell that I'm not a fanboy, so I didn't skip off work to watch the special fan day on online. But Darren, you did. So can you tell us a little bit about what people experienced and what we learned?
Yeah, I have to say, I thought this was an incredible way to publicise a film that at the end of it, I'd forgotten is actually here in 5 or so weeks' time. I mean, it's out for the Christmas holidays, obviously, and it's our annual trip back to Middle Earth. But I thought, as a fan event, I think it's unprecedented. I don't think I've ever seen anything else like this happen with such a global simultaneousness.
Mm, simultaneousness. Well done. You speak good England. what did the fans experience yesterday?
Well, from what I can tell, there was two different experiences, which I think, have to say, slightly irked me. At around about 11 o'clock yesterday morning our time in New Zealand, they kind of fired up this four-way webcast. I think it was LA, London, and Wellington as well, and one other location which I've completely forgotten. All hosted by Anderson Cooper, looking rather slick and all that kind of stuff. And it was just basically a chance for the fans to head down to places like the embassy in Wellington, and I think London's West End, to be part of an experience and a chance to meet some of, catch up with some of the cast. I think the LA one in particular was really quite clever because it introduced the character Toriel, which is new in this, this Hobbit series played by Lost Star Evangeline Lely. It was their chance to kind of showcase her and a couple of the newer kind of elements of the film that Peter Jackson and his team have adapted to bring in to maybe add some and meat to the bone of the last film.
There are a lot of new faces in this one, aren't there? And in fact, Benedict Cumberbatch plays two of them.
He's the dragon Smaug, isn't he? And I think the necromancer in the first one. But I think you didn't get too much of a shot of him. I wonder somehow if maybe they're holding that back for the actual film itself. I know there was a little bit of mixed reaction, shall we say, to the reveal of Smaug in the first trailer.
Yeah.
So with people saying that it was unfinished and it didn't look right. I don't know what these people were on because I thought it looked exciting and enticing.
Now,
isn't that what a trailer's supposed to do?
Well, that's right. Now, I know that you pay very close attention to your stats and your traffic and the hits on your website. Do you feel like there's a buzz for this second Hobbit movie that goes beyond maybe the hardcore fans? Or how do you feel that, you know how in the US now they have this very important tracking statistics where all of the studios are keeping an eye on exactly what the social media buzz and how people are talking? Do you get the feeling that this one's going to make $1 billion like the last one did?
Yeah, I think so. I think all of the people who were already in before are back in for it. I think it's probably fair to say that I don't think the first film won too many new converts. You'd already had the three Lord of the Rings films. You were either in that world at that point or you weren't. I don't think it was when you have a launch of these kind of blockbusters and these franchises, there's always a feeling with the audience of a toe dipping going on. I think there's a testing of the waters to see if new people will come or if the fans, whether they hate it or dislike it, they will or love it or loathe it. They're going to be there regardless because they want to be part of the buzz. They want to be part of the whole, well, I didn't like that bit and how dare they do that to my favorite scene in the book.
Yeah.
So they are always going to go. I think the test with these films, with any of these films, is that it's the newbies. It's getting the newbies out of the seats and into the cinema to see it. And I think the first one did that. I don't think it kind of met people's expectations in terms of perhaps pacing, and perhaps people were expecting a little bit more.
Well, apparently this next one's going to be half an hour shorter.
We'll
be able to. If we go to a matinee, we'll leave in daylight.
And on the same day as well. So that's probably a good thing. But I think this one is more the meat and potatoes of the film. And certainly some of the sequences that I think they showcased over the internet yesterday seemed to show that there was a lot more action. And the two trailers that we've had before have already showed that there's a lot more action and a lot more kind of interaction and that kind of stuff. But I think the thing that I vaguely got from this Hobbit fan event yesterday was how quickly it started to trend on Twitter. It was massive. People were talking all about it. Everyone was lost in the cacophony of this in their streams. And I think that was a very, very clever piece of global marketing to release all of that kind of stuff simultaneously.
Yeah.
To have people like Jed Brophy chatting to Sir Peter Jackson and Wellington in amongst an audience of fans and people who'd queued to be part of it. I don't quite understand how people got tickets to it because I don't remember ever seeing anything saying that they're on sale or how to be part of it.
I wonder in Wellington whether it was just a question of turning up early enough.
Yeah, and from what I saw of the footage of people, there were enough people there for that and there were enough people dressed up. So I think there's still, there's a kind of level of support for The Hobbit and The Desolation of Smaug that I think transcends a bit of jingoism. I think it goes beyond the fact that it's one of our own. It's shot in Wellington, and it's become a global epic. And the fact that they've decided to turn this into three films, I think has really, I think it's galvanized people to watching it, and I think it's maybe piqued a lot of curiosity between the people who feel that, yeah, I've seen it before, but what are they going to do this time? And I think there's still stuff that they are holding back that we haven't seen yet that we'll see on the screen. And I kind of got a feeling with that yesterday because the cameras frustratingly went off at about 5 to 12 with Peter Jackson just saying, and this is where we bid farewell to our online crowd. And I just thought,
did the people in the cinemas get something extra?
Yes, and I think that was part of it. There was part of a feeling that you were rewarded for your loyalty and your reward. And I applaud that. I think that's fantastic. And I can understand that there's maybe a nervousness from the studios about showcasing large chunks of the footage, because I know Peter Jackson himself said yesterday that they didn't want him to show extended peaks. And that's what he did for the people who stayed behind in the audience.
Right.
And I just thought I really wanted to see that. I kind of felt maybe second-class citizen a little bit. But
well, look, I tell you, if you want to feel like a second-class citizen, then it'll be the fact that the media weren't really invited to take a seat at the thing, and not even cinema owners who are actually going to be playing the film in 5 weeks' time got an invitation to it. So it really was just for those people dedicated enough to turn up at the very early hours of the morning.
Yeah, and I think that's what it is. I mean, it's a fan event, isn't it? Mm. I mean, whether that becomes the way forward for other films, I can't think of anything else coming up or being made that would command such a global audience and such a global way of bringing the cast together. There were a lot of snippets with the interviews with people. There didn't seem to be too much time to go into a lot with the members that have been there. I mean, I think Andy Serkis was out, and as was Jed Brophy as well, and a few of the others, and Luke Evans, one of the new characters, I believe I'm right saying, and Orlando Bloom was there. There was a lot of screaming and a lot of wailing when he got up to do a bit of dancing, and the fact that he revealed that he called his character Leggy instead of Legolas. So there was very much the kind of fan element to it.
Yeah.
I don't think it was ever meant to be anything other than that. I don't think it was a reveal to the media. There was a show of some production diaries, which were fascinating stuff about the post-production they've been doing, and a lot of talk that it's very sad that this is over, really. I think it was a lot of that came from it. When Jed Brophy said he'd do it all again in a heartbeat, I think there is a feeling of finality with this one, even though this isn't the last film. Mm. I wonder if this is perhaps the end of the road for a lot of them.
Well,
really,
they may not have intended much media attention for it and for it to be for the fans. We've just talked about it for about 15 minutes, so I think that they've definitely got their money's worth there. In other news announced today, Lionsgate have announced that the Saw franchise is being restarted, with Saw 8 apparently now in active development, which apparently means that they're thinking really, really hard about it. And no director attached or any stars as yet, but I wouldn't imagine it's too long down the track before we'll get a release date for Saw 8. I'm sure you're thrilled about that, Darren.
I can't wait. I think I've seen a couple of the Saw films, so whether they choose to reinvent the franchise, I really don't know, because I don't quite know how they can keep it going forever. But how many did Nightmare on Elm Street get up to? Was it 75 films in the end?
something of that nature. You can never have too much of a good thing, right? And much excitement was experienced all over the net earlier on today when the Berlinale, the Berlin Film Festival, announced that Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel was going to be their opening night film. And that's all the way in February. So, you know, that's about as early an announcement as I've ever come across for one of the major film festivals. There's no word yet on whether it will also be in competition or not, but that's a sign that, you know, that film will be ready in early February, and I imagine hitting cinemas very soon after that. So now it's time to head in the direction of the dark world.
Some believe that before the universe, there was nothing. They're wrong. There was darkness, and it has survived.
Now you come to visit me, brother.
Why?
To mock. I need your help. But I wish I could trust you.
If you did, you'd be the fool I always took you for.
A sequel to another of the great Marvel comic book characters. This is Thor: The Dark World. And Darren, what did you make of this one?
Are you a fan of these Marvel films? Do you enjoy them?
Look, I have to say that it comes and goes. I enjoyed the Avengers very much, and certainly a lot more than I enjoyed the Batman film that came out in the same year. I was a little bit underwhelmed by Captain America, I must admit, and the first Thor film I felt was that I thought had extended the character of Thor, who I didn't think had much potential, to be honest, extended him about as far as he was going to go. And I was very surprised to find myself actually, in a very modest way, engaged with the family relationships and the little bit of emotion and a little bit of drama in this Thor. I didn't think that the character had it in him, but sure enough, it took about half the film before it managed it. But my interest was piqued a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I like this film overall. I didn't feel it was perfect. I think a lot of these films now, like the Captain America sequel that's coming up, obviously Iron Man 3 last year, they're all in a world now where it's post the Avengers. So you've had the big team up. There's all kinds of fallout. I mean, Tony Stark had post-traumatic stress disorder from the end of the Avengers. And Thor, I think there's some issues with this one, with Loki as well being blamed for his actions on Earth and being hauled up before the gods of Asgard to answer for his behavior. There is a nice thematic arc that's being pushed through all of these, and it flows through, that makes it feel like it's all part of a universe and it's part of a world and it's not a standalone film. But I think the problem for this film with me is it just felt a little bit too stuffed to the gills with everything. There was a lot of new cast in it. There was a lot of expanded cast parts, particularly Kat Dennings. In the first film was comedy. This time she was a lot more comedy, and Stellan Skarsgård as well. Natalie Portman, I thought, was horrendously sidelined in terms of it. She just really seems to be there to get tangled up by this mysterious goo called the ether, and then really she's kind of cast asunder, and there were subplots that really weren't developed well enough. I mean, when Jane, the Natalie Portman character, is brought to Asgard, there's clear that there's a hint of a jealous love triangle between Thor and one of his fellow warriors, played by a lady called Jamie Alexander, and Jane, and that was just kind of left to a glance and then not really explored. And I thought that would have been nice to do it, because the rest of the story is your traditional bad guy's got an evil weapon, he's going to use some kind of convergence of all the planets to wreak all kinds of destruction everywhere, and Thor can save the day.
Well, not just all kinds of destruction, Darren, but basically take us back to before the Big Bang, you know? So you know how these films, they keep having to increase the stakes, you know, because it isn't enough to just have to, you need to save your family, or you need to save Metropolis, or you need to save planet Earth. Now you have to save all the nine realms. And, you know, I'm just wondering how much more they can wind this stuff up, you know, because it should be enough. I mean, this is where I really, when I do enjoy these films, and actually why Iron Man 3 I thought was more successful than most, is because the stakes were internal in lots of ways, rather than just simply saying, you know what, we're going to add another zero to the number of people who are going to die if you don't succeed at this. You know, those things become more and more abstract when you start talking about nine realms or a universe or whatever. That seems to me to just be stretching our credulity. But anyway.
Yeah, but I think that the problem with it is that it was just so tonally choppy, and that kind of level of building works really well in comic books. When you reach the last page, it's an epic conclusion or it's a dramatic cliffhanger, and then you have to wait for the next one to come out. But in a film, when you've had, I mean, the best part of the film that really, really stood out to me was this beautiful, beautiful Viking funeral that was everything I always imagined from looking at Norse mythology when I was younger. Valhalla, big flaming pyre goes out, and a single arrow goes through the sky and sets light to this funeral pyre. And I'm not going to say who's on that or anything like that, spoil it for people. And that is just such a wonderfully, wonderfully, beautifully evocative moment. But then the next scene straight after that, it snaps into comedy. Now, that kind of closure works really well, like I think on a small page, on a comic book as an ending. On the screen, it's really quite a different kind of beast, and really gave me the feel that they were juggling narratives and had maybe one too many balls up in the air.
I'll tell you who does fare well in this particular film, and that's Anthony Hopkins as Odin, who in the very first Thor film, I felt that was about as paycheck a performance as I've ever seen from anybody. You know, literally just bookending the film with some sort of some bluster and some pomposity. Whereas I felt like it was a really good performance in this version of the story, and also very important from a thematic point of view. So you know, that was a strength for me.
Yeah, they've expanded that world very, very well. But I think also, I mean, Anthony Hopkins did really great work in it. But I think that came at the expense of Tom Hiddleston, who has been such a hit with the fans as Loki and such a great snake-like character that I just wonder really whether it's time to perhaps rest him. I mean, he's great in this, but you can't have him being the main bad guy again, because wasn't that the plot of the Avengers film? So you're kind of left with the fact that when he's on screen, he's fantastic. He brings that Machiavellian maleficence that you need in these kind of films. But you just they don't seem to know what they want to do with it. And as a result of that, you get other characters that are thrust to the fore that maybe really shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
And that was a little bit of a disappointment for me. The action scenes are fantastic. A lot going on. But also a lot of humor in it as well. And there's a great scene towards the end where Thor's jumping about, being mixed from world to world. And he ends up in the London Tube, and that's just really funny and really unexpected. And I would have liked to have seen maybe a little bit more of those kind of flourishing touches to really make it stand out and make me feel that the stakes were high enough, but it's grounded in a reality that's engaging and humanizing.
Yeah, I get the impression that a lot of the characteristics of this film have come out of audience testing rather than a particularly strong point of view from a filmmaker. I get, you know, that need to you know, amp up Loki, even though plot wise there's not really that much for him to do, is, you know, I get the feeling that there was probably another pass that given to this film after it was tested to try and sort of boost some of those things that you were saying. So in some ways, you know, that's good because it's a little bit more crowd pleasing. But at the same time, I wonder whether it's less successful as a sort of coherent whole. Anyway.
Yeah. And, as you know, the next film to come is the next Captain America. And then after that, you've got Guardians of the Galaxy is the next one being launched. So already, I mean, you can tell that they're looking to increase the size of it again. And I just hope they don't do it at the expense of everything that they've built up in the smaller moments.
Yeah, I agree. So do you have two words for Thor?
I'm torn between Hammer Time and Fantastical Overload.
Right. Well, my two words for Thor: The Dark World, but were based on watching it in 3D, and that is too dark. And that's actually not entirely fair because it has a lot of light moments. But yes, definitely 3D still not quite there in terms of your brightness. And in fact, I was talking to somebody on Twitter last night who said that they saw it in 2D, a digital 2D screening, and it looked absolutely awful. Actually, he said it looked like DVD. So you know, we're not quite there at every single location in terms of presentation quality, unfortunately. Did you see it in 3D or 2D?
It was 3D IMAX, so that was a big screen, and I thought it worked really well in terms of the establishing shots of the worlds, but the rest of it I didn't think really kind of added anything.
Yeah, I didn't think 3D added very much at all, and it also struck me that that from shot to shot within the film, it actually looked like it had been shot on something different, or it had been shot by a different cinematographer, or, you know, there was some scenes had a kind of film grain to them, some were very sort of glossy and digital, and it didn't seem that there was a sort of consistency about the look of the film either. But anyway, that is our show for this week. Next week on Cinematica, novelist Cormac McCarthy turns screenwriter for The Counselor, getting to see that a little bit later on today, in fact. The last 50 years of US political history is seen through the eyes of Forrest Whitaker in The Butler. All that and more in next week's exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, Cinematica. Cinematica. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favourite podcasting software so the latest episode always gets downloaded automatically. Don't forget, leave us feedback at the iTunes store, those ratings, those reviews. 5 stars are the ones we like the best. Just want to point that out. They're super useful to help more people discover the show. And once again, we looked at the stats just recently for October, and the October was our biggest month ever, which is fantastic. Thanks everybody for sharing it, the show amongst your friends. You can contact us via Twitter at CinematicaCast, on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast. We're Cinematica on Letterboxd, and you can also contact us at our website, cinematica.co.nz. The show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, which you can buy at the iTunes store. And we're going to leave you play out with some more music. This is Brian Tyler's theme from Thor the Dark World. It's called Thor the Dark World. Until next week, that's all from me. Thank you very much, Darren, for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much for having me. Hopefully I don't destroy the ratings and can come back another time.
I'll be coming for you if you do. Don't you worry about that. Next week on the show, Kaylee will be back and Simon will be back. We'll have the A-team, well, say-ish, team back, and we'll be back at Petone Towers, Cinematica Towers, in by the beach there. So tune in next week. Thanks very much, everybody. Good night.